Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this program, recorded on July 18, 1994, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, I talked with Benjamin Franklin, who was portrayed by Ralph Archbold. We talked while we walked towards Franklin's home and print shop at Franklin Court, where Benjamin Franklin lived. We discussed his life and times, and our conversation focused on Mr. Franklin's youth, his move to and life in Philadelphia, and also his role in the secession from England and the formation of the United States. This program was originally broadcast in 1994 when Radio Curious was called Government Politics and Ideas. Benjamin Franklin, welcome to Government Politics and Ideas.
Well, it's a pleasure indeed, young man. I'm glad you're here on Oriana Street, a very short street up to my good house here at Franklin Court.
Mr. Franklin, how old were you when you came to Philadelphia?
I was but a lad of 17. I grew up in Boston and had been in the printing business with my older brother, learning the trade. And, well, there were some difficulties. And so at the age of 17, I found myself on my way to New York. However, there was no employment available in New York, and a man there, Mr. Bradford, told me if I went to Philadelphia, I might find employment. His son had a print shop, and I might find a job. And so I walked all the way across New Jersey, rainy weather. I arrived in Philadelphia in a small boat on the Delaware River. I was cold and I was wet. My clothes were dirty. I was tired and I was hungry. But I knew that in Boston, for only 3 pennies, one could get a roll of bread. And so with the little money I did have, I went into a bakery here in Philadelphia. And I said, I would like a 3-penny roll of bread, please. And the man said, "We don't sell 3-penny rolls of bread, son." I said, "Oh, well, sir, if I might, I should like to buy 3 pennies worth of any kind of bread you do sell, please." And instead of one roll of bread, I ended up with three huge, puffy rolls of bread. And, of course, that was more than anyone could possibly eat, so I carried one roll under one arm and the second roll under the other arm. I was eating that third roll of bread as I walked up the hill here in Philadelphia, and all of a sudden, there was a young lady. She took one look at me. Wet, dirty, 3 rolls of bread, pair of stockings sticking out of one of my pockets. She laughed at me. I married her 7 years later, Deborah Reed. And I became husband and wife September 1st, 1730, and we were married until she passed away in December of 1774 of a stroke.
Mr. Franklin, before we get into some of the many things that you've done, I'm very curious about your upbringing as a child in Boston, the kind of presentation or the stimulation that you received from your mother and father that directed you or that set your mind free to investigate electricity and art and politics and government and many of the things that you enjoy so.
Well, it was a very interesting family. I was a member of a family that was rather large by the standards that you might understand. There were 17 children born into the family. My father and my mother were very religious. The Bible was in great evidence. The Mather family was there in Boston, and I was quite a bit influenced there. But my father had a very interesting practice. He was a soap boiler and candle maker, and did reasonably well in business, though we never had an exceeding amount of money. We always had plenty to eat, and many visitors would come to Boston, and he would invite friends, and they would sit at our table. As a boy, I was not allowed to speak unless asked a direct question, but I was there to listen and to learn. And he would question visitors, and I would learn very much. And I was always very curious. In fact, I cannot remember not being able to read. I don't know when I first was taught to read, but I've always enjoyed good books. A good book makes a man full. And ever since those days, I've had a great curiosity. From the times when I would be with my friends and invented a little swimming machine over near the mill pond where we used to swim, so I could swim faster than my friends, wooden paddles for my hands and feet. The time when I allowed a kite to act as a giant sail in the sky and pull me across the pond from one end to the other. I always had a great curiosity. And that curiosity, I think, has been with me all of my life. I've always wanted to know how things work, to see if I might improve things. And I've always been a little lazy, for I felt that if I could find a quicker way or an easier way to do something, it would be not only to my benefit, but to the benefit of others and my friends.
I see that you wear bifocals. Perhaps you could tell us the story of how you came to create such a wonderful spectacle, if you will.
Oh, my, such a wonderful spectacle. Yes, you know, I suppose it started when I was in about my 40th year, and I sat down to read, and I found a little problem. Everything seemed to be a little bit out of focus, and my wife and I discussed this, and she said, "Well, Benjamin, you have to see a man who is selling something called spectacles." I said, "You know, that it really is ridiculous for a man of my young age to be needing spectacles." She said, "Why don't you talk to the man anyway?" So I went to see the man, and when I told him the problem I was having, he immediately had the answer. He said, "Oh, yes, I can fix you right up," and sold me the most expensive pair of spectacles he had. And I took them home, and I put them on, and I sat down, and I opened up my book, and sure enough, they worked. I could read. Everything was bright. Everything was clear. So I called Deborah. I said, Deborah, come and see. This is wonderful. Deborah? Oh, my. I could not see my wife. Well, I could see her, but she was all out of focus. With those spectacles on, I could barely see her. So I took them off, and she still seemed to be a little bit out of focus. And, of course, I knew that when we were married, she was not out of focus. And so I went back to the man and I told him my problem. I said, "You know, I believe these spectacles have ruined my eyes, for now I cannot see my wife with them on and I cannot see her with them off." And he said, "Oh." And I had an inclination that I might be in a bit of difficulty. "What you need is another pair of spectacles." I said, "Oh, my. Now I need two. I really hadn't planned on even one, and now you're telling me I need two kinds of spectacles?" He said, "Yes, one kind for reading and another kind for seeing everything else." Well, it was years that I carried around two kinds of spectacles, and I would be sitting there reading, and friends would come in the room, and I would look up, and I couldn't see them, and I would have to change my spectacles, and then I would look at them, and they would say, "Oh, well, finish your reading," and I would look down at the book, and of course I couldn't see it. You know, all I did, it seems, was take them off and put them on. Finally, in my 78th year, I was over in Paris, and I made a drawing of a large round frame with two pieces of glass, flat in the middle, held together by the frame. One in the bottom would be for reading, one in the top for seeing across the room, for the natural inclination is to look down when one is reading and to look up when one is looking across the room. So I would only need to shift my eyes, not change my spectacles. Some friends found the drawing, had them made up for me, and all of a sudden, you could see things looking up. I never marketed, I never sold the spectacles, and of course I'm not a glassmaker, I could never have made them myself. But I understand that invention is in wider use.
Mr. Franklin, we're here under your mulberry tree in Franklin Court. Tell me a little bit about the importance of the tree and why it's here.
Well, it's a very special place here at Franklin Court. Of course, in the summer in Philadelphia, it does get a little hot. But every important visitor to Philadelphia, especially during our federal convention in 1787, would stop here under the mulberry tree, seek a little counsel, a little refreshment. And I've always said, be generous with that which costs little, sincere interest, friendship, and good counsel. And it was wonderful to see friends from all of our 13 new states come here. So ever since 1785, when I returned from France, I have received visitors here. And of all the important visitors who have arrived here, of course, you are the most recent. I hear some visitors approaching now.
A group of school children, it looks like. You receive visitors here every morning and tell a few stories about your life?
Yes, I've been doing that under this mulberry tree. Now, every morning this summer I've been receiving visitors here. I start about 9 in the morning and go until about 11. And they come by and we have a little chat. And I even give them a little postcard because I have been the postmaster, you know. first postmaster for our new country, Postmaster General. And, of course, in the early years, we didn't have postage stamps, and the person who got the letter had to pay for it. And if you didn't pay for it, you didn't get the letter. But I understand it is much more convenient now that postage stamps have arrived.
Let me take a moment and say that you're listening to Government Politics and Ideas. I'm talking with Benjamin Franklin in Franklin Court in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on July 18th, 1994. Mr. Franklin, you're often referred to as Dr. Franklin. Why is this?
Well, I did receive honorary degrees from St. Andrews in Scotland at first, and from many universities, honorary degrees from Harvard, Yale, William and Mary, Oxford. And of course, I was quite honored for a man with only 2 years of formal education. Of course, I say formal education, for education does not stop when schooling ends. Life is a continual process of education, and we determine how thorough that education will be by exposing ourselves to important ideas, such as this program you're talking about. This is very important. We need to constantly stay alert and be aware of what is going on about us. Well, when we set up this nation, it was with the hope that people would realize that everything was in their hands, the future of this nation, the future of this world, for the seeds of ingenuity, the seeds of cooperation, the seeds of freedom are always in the hands of the people, but they must continually be planted and watered and fertilized, or they cannot grow. That is education.
Your friend and colleague, Thomas Jefferson, has called for a revolution every 20 years. What is your response to that call?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that when we wrote that Constitution in 1787, and young Tom was over there in Paris at the time, we resisted the temptation to etch a document in stone that could not be changed. And I suppose that there is a constant revolution in this world and a constant revolution in America. And the great value of that Constitution was that it did not have to be changed by a violent revolution, but by an evolving of ideas and people making changes in the document rather than throwing it away and starting all anew.
One of the changes that I've always appreciated, and I've wondered in the formation of the Constitution, that is calling black people only three-fifths of a person. What was your response to the necessity of that compromise? And I understand that it was necessary to compromise, otherwise we may not have formed the Union. But prior to the compromise, what were your feelings?
Well, I had started out in my early years not knowing much about the situation of slavery or being very familiar with those people of color. And when I was in London, the Bray Associates were educating young black children, and I observed that they were every bit as capable and intelligent as any white children that I had been acquainted with. So I became involved in the idea that we needed to have equal education, equal opportunity. Unfortunately, there was that situation that we would have no government at all. We would have no beginning if we did not compromise on that. And I was not comfortable with that compromise. I became the founder, one of the founders, and the president of the Society to Abolish Slavery, our first anti-slavery society here in America. And I wrote that this was something that could not be accepted by a nation that planned to call itself civilized. So I was not comfortable with that. I realized that it was a step that had to be taken. And while there were things in that Constitution that I did not entirely feel that I would have chosen, it was indeed the best document that we could have obtained at that time and was a starting point. And again, that feature of being able to change, to amend, was very important. We immediately began to work on a Bill of Rights, and that was a very important step. But those rights had to be extended to all, and we knew that.
You were the elder statesman at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. In fact, I recall that you were carried in to the convention in a small little carriage, a hand-carried carriage that I believe you had perhaps designed yourself. And my question, sir, is how you saw your influence at that convention to promote the ideas that you felt were necessary for the formation of the Union.
Well, I indeed was the senior, as you call it, statesman there. Perhaps because of that was accorded some respect, but not always listened to. The sedan chair that you referred to was not my original design, but one that had been crafted for me. I had a problem with the gout and with a stone, and I was a bit uncomfortable. I was not always conveyed in that manner, but on occasion I was conveyed to the convention by the sedan chair. I sat there and seemed to be somewhat of a peacekeeping force. The young delegates, who were very hot of temper on occasion and very active in their minds and in their vigor of their vitality of youth, were ranting and raving about certain things. Older delegates were sometimes at odds with them, and I tried to step between. When one has a board that does not fit, one must take a little bit off each end and make a compromise. And I hope to help people make a compromise. The large states were afraid that the small states were trying to take away their money, and the small states thought the large states wanted to take away their freedom. The South didn't trust the North, and the regions of trade didn't trust the regions of agriculture. We had to learn to work together. We could not go as 13 states acting as if they were 13 different countries.
Tell me about this issue of the small states and the large states and the money and the freedom. Yet from your perspective, did you feel that there was a validity to that?
Oh, there certainly is always a validity in the feelings of individuals, for there was a basis for this. When we started our convention, we were to begin on the 14th of May, and a week later only Pennsylvania and Virginia had arrived, and, well, we were here because we lived here, but Virginia came with a plan that favored the large states. And then New Jersey developed a plan for the small states. These were very serious problems because we had to unite as 13 United States, or we were going to be embarrassed all over the world as everything fell apart. And so the compromise was essential, but not all could see the necessity of compromise and how the compromise might work. And, of course, Roger Sherman from Connecticut was instrumental in setting up that compromise, and I did what little I could to urge the delegates in that direction. Now, I know that it's been said I was sleeping during some of the meetings, and then on the same vein, people said I was telling secrets that were going on in our convention, and of course, you can't have it both ways, but I tried to do what little I could at my 81st year to influence our nation in a direction that might allow a republic to last. And as Mrs. Powell, wife of the former mayor of Philadelphia, asked me when we exited from the State House, at the conclusion of the meeting, what sort of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin? I replied, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. And I hope it will continue to be kept.
One of the issues that concerned your friend Thomas Jefferson was decentralized government versus a centralized government that Alexander Hamilton was promoting. What are your views on this issue?
Well, of course, we had just gone through problems with the king, and we were a bit afraid of some of the things that a strong federal government would lead us to. But it was important that we have a federal government that was stronger than that of under the Articles of the Confederation, or we would not survive. There had to be a balance, and a system of checks and balances between the legislative, the executive, and the judicial would be an answer. An answer that might help us preserve a union.
Yet we have a federal judiciary that is appointed, that is not responsible really to anyone unless they're involved in such severe corruption that they are impeached. Does that not smack of a reign of royalty?
Well, appointed by the executive and approved by the legislative. So there should be some checks and balances there, for we find frequently the executive and the legislative bodies are somewhat at odds, and we hope there will be enough conflict to set up a little tension so that there's not a compliance and a judicial decision based upon interests of one party over another, rather than interests of law.
Let me change the topic here a little bit. It's been reported in storybook folklore that you have a little friend, a little mouse, who's written about his friend, and he calls it Ben and Me. Can you tell us a little bit about your little friend?
Well, his name is Amos. He seems to have appeared at the behest of a man named Robert Lawson in a little volume, Ben and Me. And ever since Walt Disney adopted him and made a movie, he thinks he's a movie star and resides in Hollywood sitting by a swimming pool wearing sunglasses looking at all the cute girl mice. And quite frankly, well, I hope it's raining. But I would urge you to remember that mice are terrible liars. Don't believe everything Amos tells you.
Then let me ask you about your literary work of Poor Richard's Almanac.
You know, the idea came actually from my older brother. He was publishing an almanac called Poor Robin's Almanac up in Rhode Island. And I was having problems financially. I needed to print an almanac, publish an almanac of my own, but printing two almanacs for others, I could not come out with Ben Franklin's Almanac. He suggested I use an interesting-sounding name, and the name Richard Saunders seemed appealing to me. The Richard Saunders I had heard of in the 1600s was no longer around. He wasn't using his name anymore, so I borrowed it. He never complained. The idea of the juxtaposition of poor and rich, Poor Richard, intrigued me. I said I was not a rich man. I was a poor man. I was not one of the landed gentry, one of the idle rich who was doing this almanac as a hobby, but a man who, supporting his family, needed the purchase of this almanac by friends who would help in that endeavor. And it became very successful. We were selling about 10,000 copies a year at a time when well, there were only about 25,000 people here in Philadelphia.
And you printed them yourself here at Franklin Court?
I would print them myself in my print shop. David Hall later on took over. And we would gather the information all year long, and we would have them printed by the middle of October and usually sold out by the middle of November. It was a very popular thing. It not only gave all the advice of when the sun would rise and set and what the weather was going to be, but it had little sayings, bits of wisdom that I would even hope people today still are interested in.
How were you able to forecast the rise and setting of the sun, which perhaps was a bit more systematic than the weather?
Well, I didn't do all of it myself, but there were those who were involved in the studies of the heavenly bodies and could very accurately predict things. Now, the weather, on the other hand, was best accomplished by doing a charting of the weather over a number of years. We realized after a short study that it very rarely snowed in August and was not all that hot in January, so there were some generalities. And if I predicted a rainstorm for today and it arrived 2 or 3 days earlier or 2 or 3 days later, everyone was very generous and said, see, he got another one right. So I was given a lot of license with the almanac, and people loved reading the sayings of poor Richard, and they, of course, used the almanac as their calendar, their daily calendar.
Can you tell us one of your more favorite sayings?
Oh, well, I have many favorites. A true friend is the best possession. The noblest question in the world is, what good may I do in it? And then some that people are more familiar with. Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And it does work for women also. But, of course, that is open to interpretation, for early to bed could be early in the morning. Early to rise could be early in the afternoon. Wonderful sayings. Waste not, want not, no gains without pains, an empty bag cannot stand upright. If you lie down with dogs, you'll get up with fleas. 3 people can keep a secret if 2 of them are dead. Wonderful sayings. There were over 650 throughout the years, and if you follow all that advice, you'll never get into trouble. You won't have any time, for you'll be too following advice.
Mr. Franklin, one of the questions I always like to ask people at the close of an interview, could you tell our listeners about an interesting book that you would recommend?
My autobiography, of course. You know, if you follow my plan, my 13 virtues, my plan for success, if you follow all of the good advice in my autobiography, it certainly will not hurt you at all, and it may benefit you, and you will find a rich and rewarding life. I would say that you should base your reading in the classics, and you should always remember that the genius of a well-read person is in that education you have received through those books. Don't forego your education after your schooling.
Benjamin Franklin, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on Government, Politics, and Ideas.
Thank you, indeed. It's wonderful that you stopped by here at Franklin Court. If you've noticed, only the framework is left of my home, which should be a lesson to everyone. Don't leave anything to your relatives. They won't take care of it.
And I'd like to welcome Ralph Archbold to Government, Politics, and Ideas, who has portrayed our friend Benjamin Franklin.
Well, it's good to be here.
How is it that you have adopted this persona and presented it so beautifully here?
Well, I've been doing this now about 21 years, and I started at a historic village in Michigan, Greenfield Village, which Henry Ford started in 1929, and now I'm here in Philadelphia. I've been here for about 12 years. I live in the historic area. I do programs at Independence Hall, here at Franklin Court, which is the former home of Benjamin Franklin, and all of the programs for the Franklin Institute, the University of Pennsylvania, Freedoms Foundation, and I have a wonderful time doing it.
What do you foresee as your role in bringing this out, speaking as a person who lived so many years ago?
Well, you know, the nice thing about being Franklin is you can never get too old. And now in Franklin's 288th year, and and my 52nd year, I've really been enjoying this. I share the same birthday as Ben Franklin, January 17th, a few years apart. I can never get too old to play the part, and I don't ever plan to stop doing it.
And let me ask you the same question that I just asked Ben Franklin. Could you recommend an interesting book to our listeners?
Well, of course, I would also recommend the autobiography. But I think that whatever is your interest, you need to find as many varied resources to give you a broad perspective so that you don't too narrowly focus, so that you can get the big picture. Be well read.
Ralph Archbold, thank you very much for being with us here on Government, Politics, and Ideas.
A pleasure indeed.
This conversation with Benjamin Franklin, as portrayed by Ralph Archbold, occurred in July of 1994, when Radio Curious was called Government, Politics, and Ideas. Benjamin Franklin and Ralph Archbold both recommended the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin by Benjamin Franklin. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.